will you follow the will of God, the will of the Father? And Jesus passes the test. He lays down his life. He proves whose God is really in control. The gods of this world claim that they hold all the cards, that death is in their hand, and they wield it against whomever they will. But Jesus and Daniel prove that true life and true ruling happens whenever we obey God's commands, despite the fact that it looks like they'll end in our death.
Welcome to the Spoken Gospel Podcast. Spoken Gospel is a ministry that's dedicated to speaking the gospel out of every corner of Scripture. In Luke 24, Jesus told his disciples that every part of the Bible was about him. So each week, hosts David and Seth work through a passage of Scripture to see how it's all about Jesus and his good news. Let's jump in.
Well, welcome everyone to the Spoken Gospel Podcast. Thank you so much for joining us. We are in Daniel chapter 1 today. So, right. Seth, how you feeling?
I'm feeling really excited.
Yeah.
There's a lot that happened. I'm excited for the book of Daniel.
In general. We got to unpack a lot of that in the introduction episode.
Yeah, and I love the opening of the book of Daniel.
You do?
Yeah.
It's really so sad, though.
Yes. it is sad. I like sad
things. I like sad. I'm a very melancholy person. So whenever a book starts off and people are being carted away from their homes, and
I'm like,
you're like,
it's a good day for Seth Stewart.
so terrible.
Well, it's just the story of the 10-day test and the food and them gaining weight on a diet of vegetables.
That is cool.
And also all the parallels with the Joseph narrative, all the things that we've discovered with the temple. I'm just excited for everything that's on the line in Daniel 1.
I'll let you off the hook for that. I'm excited too. So Daniel chapter 1, right? It starts off and it sets up what's on the line in the book of Daniel. The people of Israel have been carted away from their homeland and the temple has been robbed. Why is that so significant?
So you can read about it in 2 Kings 24.
Okay.
The king Jehoiakim is carted off away into exile. And then this is what it says in verse 2. And the Lord gave Jehoiakim, king of Judah, into Nebuchadnezzar's hand, in some of the vessels of the house of God, and he brought them to the land of Shinar, to the house of his God, and placed the vessels in the treasury of his God.
This is such a loaded verse.
So many things are happening right here. The first thing you see is the destruction of the people and nation of God. That's a big deal.
Yes, and it's ratcheted up by the very first words of verse 2.
Yeah,
and the Lord gave. It's like, hold on. So it's not, right from the start, it's not, and so God's people were overpowered, you know, or, and so Jehoiakim was outwitted by military strategy. No, this is a spiritual exile.
Yeah, and 2 Kings 24 tells us that. It says in 2 Kings 24, for surely all these things happened to Judah according to the Lord's command in order to remove them from his presence because of the sins of Manasseh in all that he had done, including the shedding of innocent blood. He had filled Jerusalem with innocent blood, and the Lord was not willing to forgive.
Right. So this exile and destruction of the temple is a result of Israel's sin and a direct act of God himself.
Yes.
Like, I think of the prophet Ezekiel, and Ezekiel kind of has this vision of God's chariot riding out to war.
Yeah. And then, is that the one with all the eyes?
All
and
the
wheels?
Eyes and everything. And then it's like, but the weird thing is, it's riding toward the temple. God is riding out to war against his own house.
Mm.
And it's terrifying.
Yeah.
And then here in Daniel, it's happened, and the people are being carted off.
Yeah.
Okay, so like,
and it's a big deal because the nation of Israel, the kingdom of God, in that stage of God's plan for redemptive history was, that's how God was going to rule the world. He was going to rule from Israel.
Yes.
He was going to rule from his temple. He was going to usher in a reign of peace and justice for all people from Jerusalem. So for Jerusalem to be burned and then the artifacts of God's temple to be stashed in the temple of another God.
Right.
This means that the era of God's people has ended.
Yes.
Right?
Yeah. And, and their access to God is completely cut off.
Access to God, the ability for God's kingdom to move forward. Like,
yeah.
God's plans have stopped when Nebuchadnezzar took over, or so it seems.
Yeah.
Or so
but it's being done in God's hand.
Right.
That's the weird thing. And so, like, that should
So if God is controlling of the fact that his own kingdom and his own temple is destroyed,
his plans can't.
Is it really
be
destroyed?
Because he's the one doing it. It is his plan.
And this, us sarcastically questioning back and forth, that's the tension
that's
of the
tension.
Book of Daniel.
Yes. And so what? So that's on the line. What else is on the line here is the vessels are being carried away.
Mm-hmm.
The temple is being gutted.
Yep.
And this is so significant because Israel's worship of God has now been halted.
Yeah,
that they are no longer able to make their sacrifices, their offerings, their incense. How will their sins be atoned for?
Yeah.
Like, how will they commune with God? How will they be in his presence?
Not
how will
only
God be
the,
among them?
Yeah, not only is the temple burned.
Right.
Everything inside of it is now booty.
Right.
It's just warts.
And it's not, and it, yeah, and it's now in the house of a false god in Babylon.
Yep. But there's also, in the same way, if God controls the exile, maybe he can bring them out of exile. There's also a little bit of weird hope here, too. There's another story in the Bible where the vessels of God's house are carted off to another nation. It's in the book of Samuel, when the Ark of the Covenant is stolen by the Philistines and goes through these five different cities. And as it's in those five different cities, plagues of rats and tumors comes on each city until they get rid of it and can go back to Israel. So it's also maybe a hint that, well, they've stolen God's things. Maybe the same thing will happen again.
Oh, maybe the vessels that they stole from the temple will end up being a judgment against them?
Yes.
And that
actually happens.
That
happens. In Daniel chapter
5. That's so interesting because Belshazzar actually takes the vessels out of the treasury so he can drink from them?
To his own power and celebrating his own gods. And it's in that moment when that type of blasphemy finally comes that God strips the kingdom from.
And Babylon is given over to the Medes and the Persians.
Yes.
Okay.
It's kind of the shotgun over the mantelpiece. It's going to get fired later on.
So the vessel being taken out is like a, just wait to see what happens with this. It's like the Ark of the Covenant again.
It's like the Ark of the Covenant again. But to your point too, it's also representative of proper worship of God that's been halted and stopped.
Right.
And the hopelessness and the wondering, Will we ever get back to where we were supposed to? Will God ever reign from Jerusalem again?
Right. And it's like, it's really hard, I think, for us today, for several reasons, to know why that's so significant. I don't even know if I'm going to be able to articulate it well enough, but I'll try. Like, think about, I think it's because, for one, we don't see worship as tied to place. We don't see God's presence as tied to place. Right, God's presence is everywhere. You can worship him everywhere. You can pray to him anywhere. You can sing songs to him anywhere. And it's equally good no matter where you do it from.
Yeah.
And that's true. That's absolutely true.
It was true for Israel too.
Right. But kind of.
Yeah.
Kind of. I would actually take a little bit of issue with that.
Well, God says it. He says, I don't dwell in temples, be my man. He says that to Solomon.
He does, but then he chooses to as a condescension.
Yes.
And he also says, do not make sacrifices to me anywhere except this one place.
That's right.
And he says, if you try to make a sacrifice outside somewhere else, I'm going to kill you.
I mean, we have that same sense of rootedness and placedness in Christianity.
Mm.
The place of sacrifice is Jesus Christ.
Right.
There's a specificity.
Salvation is found in no one else.
Right. Like, there is a specificity, a rootedness to our worship, but also an acknowledgement of, like, God is everywhere, but he is especially in the image of Jesus Christ.
Yes.
We have that same, there's a spiritual and physical embodied reality for us as Christians that was national and religious
It was in a building.
Right. So, I mean, that's interesting.
That's really helpful.
In the same way that we're like, there's only salvation in Jesus.
Mm-hmm.
There's only salvation in the temple.
Yeah, Daniel can pray to God in Babylon, but salvation is found in nowhere else but the temple.
Yeah.
So if the temple's gone, what's going to happen? Like, how are we and God going to be okay?
Can I up the ante a little bit
on
that
too? Please, yes.
So, like, that's all on the line. And where is all God's temple things?
In Babylon's courts.
Then in the land of Shinar. If you remember from Genesis 11, the land of Shinar was where the Tower of Babel was built.
Mm-hmm.
And Babel, there is the word Babylon. It's the same word all throughout Scripture. It's
right.
Just translate Babel in that one place. Babylon, there, all the articles of God are in the place that God cursed. And Babylon has been rebuilt. Like, maybe this is the final word of where God's people should live. In the Babel story, Babylon was built, it was torn down, and God made his own people in Abraham.
Right.
God's people have had a chance to have a kingdom. It's fallen, and it's all been absorbed back into Babel. Yeah. Babylon has retaken over the world.
Yeah.
Will God curse it again?
Right.
And the implicit, it goes back and forth. This is the final word of the empire of Babylon. Or
maybe this is the final word against the people of God.
Yeah, or will God do what he did to Babylon again?
Right.
Was what happened to Babel about to be repeated in Babylon?
Yes. And so we'll find out. That is what happens.
Yes.
And it's like, so what's going to happen? Like, what hope is there when the place of God's worship and salvation is torn down and the vessels are carted off? The priests are nowhere to be found, the people who mediate between God and man. What hope is there? Who can stand in the gap between the people of God and a broken temple? They need a new and a different kind of mediator, a priest to go between them. And that is the next clue we get when we're introduced to Daniel and his friends.
Yeah. The king commanded Ashpenaz, his chief eunuch, to bring some of the people of Israel, both the royal family and of nobility. So this was part of the Babylonian colonization method. They would skim off the top of the nations they conquered, the best and the brightest students, and then indoctrinate them into the culture of Babylon.
Yeah, they put them in a 3-year crash course.
Yes, on how to be good Babylonians, to be the best representatives to their people on Babylonian values. So the idea here is like, oh no, you can trust, these were your kings, these were your leaders previously. And they agree with Babylon.
We've brainwashed them now.
And they agree with us. So follow your old leaders, your old politicians. But what's interesting, so that's like
That's culturally their strategy. Yeah.
But then verse 4, they are youths without blemish, of good appearance and skillful in all wisdom, endowed with knowledge, understanding, learning, and competent to stand in the king's palace and to teach them literature in the language of the Chaldeans. So on one level, it just sounds like, okay, these are the cream of the crop. This is the best of the best of Israel, and we're going to brainwash them so that they can communicate to our other conquered Israelites that we are really in control and they shouldn't try to revolt, which, by the way, is what Jehoiakim tried to do.
Oh, really?
When Nebuchadnezzar conquers Jehoiakim, which is what we're told in verse 1, he then tries to lead a revolt.
Oh, right.
So by taking away all the politicians and brainwashing them, you're undermining
the ability to revolt.
Yes, or the will of the people to revolt.
Yeah, that's interesting.
But the most that's interesting for the just as a demonstration of the power of Babylon.
Totally.
Wouldn't you want to submit under these circumstances?
you have to submit under these circumstances?
But what's interesting is that phrase, the young youths without blemish.
Yeah, the blemish thing. So that's the Hebrew word meum, which is a kind of a rare word in the Hebrew Bible. And as you look at it throughout the Hebrew scriptures, with a few exceptions, it is always tied to the qualifications of the priests.
The priests need to be without blemish?
That's right. The priests had to be without blemish. So Leviticus 21 and 22 outline this for the first time. In 22, God is speaking to Moses and tells Aaron, the first chief priest, and says this. He says, "None of your offspring, your young people, throughout their generations who has a blemish," same word, "may approach to offer the bread of his God."
Interesting.
And then he goes on to find what kind of blemish is, what qualifies as a blemish. So is only those without blemish can come near. Same thing is said of the type of sacrifices that could come to God. Only a lamb without blemish, right?
Interesting.
And so you have this priestly qualification being given to this group of people, of which Daniel is going to be a subset.
It's interesting. What it keeps making me think is it keeps, like we say, like these things could mean two things. The fact that God's in control could mean that this is the end of Israel, or it could mean that he could bring them out.
Right.
The fact that it's in Shinar could be that Babylon is finally won, or the Babylon will fall like it did before.
Mm-hmm.
It could be that the vessel has been stolen and absorbed by another god, proving his power, or it could be the shotgun on the mantelpiece, proving that it's going to die. And now we have sacrificial priests.
Right.
And then they're in the indoctrination camp of king of Babylon. And he goes on in verse 5, the king assigned them food that the king ate, which is, this is an invitation to his table.
Really important. Yeah.
And then if they did well, they would stand before the king. And then these priests of God are given Babylonian names.
Yes.
And I've heard this before. I'd have to go back and check, but they might all be riffs on Babylonian gods' names.
Oh, yes.
So, which is interesting. So you have potential priests of God named after the gods of Babylon.
That's right.
So have the people of God been absorbed by the gods of Babylon?
The answer comes in the test.
In the test.
In the test. And it's really important how it starts. So verse 8 of chapter 1 says, "But Daniel resolved that he would not defile himself with the king's food." So another big part of Leviticus 21 and 22, along with the blemishes, is that a priest cannot be defiled, especially by food or by sex or by touching a dead body, anything like that.
This is more like sacramental.
That's right, sacramental language.
Yeah.
And again, we're seeing that Daniel is a priest without blemish. And, well, how's it going to go? You know, is he going to be the brainwashed priest of the Babylonian gods, or is he going to stay true to Yahweh? Well, he's going to resolve here not to defile himself with the king's food. He is choosing to obey the Torah that sat inside the temple, even whenever it's destroyed. And he's going to remain ceremonially clean so that he can continue the priestly office that he's being set up to fulfill.
That's interesting. He never says that. Daniel never says that he knows that he's a priest.
Nope.
Or that he functions as a priest. But yeah. Clearly the author of Daniel,
yes,
was pulling on some of these like priestly languages and I mean, because that's on the line, right? We said it. It's like temple's on the line. The leadership of Israel is on the line, because the priests weren't just religious figures like pastors are today.
Right.
They were part of the leading class of people. The king would have a high priest that he consulted with about the law of the land.
That's what you would be thinking about if you were reading this. Like if I said a school bus full of kids was driving down the highway and it was stopped by robbers, and the robbers came in and they took out all the seats of the school bus, and they ripped off the stop sign off the side of the school bus, and they carted it off to their place. You'd be like, well, but what happened to the teacher and the school bus driver and the kids? You'd be asking the question of like, hold on, the temple's not just a place with stuff in it. It's also a place with people in it.
Right.
And so as soon as the temple's destroyed, you're like, but what happened to the priests?
Right,
it's like,
right.
Oh, well, there's people without blemish who are not defiling themselves. Ding, ding, ding. Like,
yeah, the author's like, don't worry. We can still worship God. God's still in control.
Right.
He's still above the gods of Babylon. Like nothing's out of God's control
right
yet.
So, the author of Daniel is setting Daniel up as a symbolic priest in this moment.
Interesting.
Yeah.
Okay. And then he asks one of the chief eunuchs to allow him not to defile himself. And God gave Daniel favor and compassion in the sight of the chief of the eunuchs. But the chief of the eunuchs was afraid to do this because basically the king could have his head. And if Daniel was seen to be of lesser health than the other men, it would be his head for it.
That's right.
So, which is also an interesting like bit of dramatic tension to add here. You have this king who's being really, really generous. You eat at the king's table.
Oh, right.
Drink his food. Drink his wine. Refuse, you die.
Yeah, right.
And if Daniel is being set up as a type of representative of God's religion, the religion of Yahweh, Nebuchadnezzar is this other pole in that,
yes,
right?
Yes.
He's the leader of a new religion. So, and that one holds the cards of death. Can the God that's already been conquered, can the priest of the God that's already, whose temple's already been destroyed, survive in the
right
temple of this new God
right
with this new food and these new religious
it's
practices?
It's not just a test of Daniel's faith. It's a test of God.
Yeah.
Like, is God still going to win
yeah
when his temple's been destroyed? I also was
is
thinking,
God God or is Nebuchadnezzar God?
Yes.
Yes.
Right. That's the test. And I was also thinking like, oh, like this plays in with the whole like without blemish thing, because the problem that the chief of the eunuchs brings up is, hey man, if you don't eat the food and drink the wine, you're going to be gaunt and skinny
right
and pale. You're going to be blemished.
Oh yeah.
The king doesn't want you working in his temple if you're blemished. He wants you looking fat and healthy because it's a representative of who he is. I am rich and generous and powerful, and so my priests are fat and well-fed and rosy-cheeked. And he's like, you can't be who he wants you to be if you show up looking bad. And he's like, no, I guarantee you, if I stick to the laws of my God, I will look like a true priest.
It's interesting. The way that I wrote this in the devotional, I think this is right. Like, Daniel has a choice in this moment. Will he trust the God that sent him into exile? Or will he be wooed by the power and promises of Nebuchadnezzar? And Daniel must decide if God is in charge of his suffering or if Nebuchadnezzar is in charge of his promotion. Like, what I see? Like, there's like a real... God seems to only be on the powerless side of things. Nebuchadnezzar seems to be on the up.
He has all the cards.
And has all the cards. Yeah. And Daniel's still choosing to align himself with the God of exile before the God of the empire. Interesting. So the test. He sets up a test.
Yeah.
So basically says, okay, I know you can't just... I know what the situation you're in. And he says, just test us for 10 days. And after 10 days, we don't look as good as the king's other men. We'll switch.
So let's set this up here. Daniel is not saying, hey, we're all a little overweight, and so we're going to do the Daniel diet and lose some weight. That's the opposite is happening.
Right.
Because I think when we think about the Daniel diet,
my mom went on the Daniel diet at some point.
it's like, oh, I do the Daniel diet of vegetables and water to lose weight. It's like, no, eat vegetables, drink water, lose weight. That there's nothing wrong with that at all.
But
the point of what's happening here is Daniel said that there's going to be a miracle that happens, that he's going to drink water and eat broccoli and get fat. While other people are eating steak and drinking wine, he's going to get fatter than them by water and broccoli.
Yeah, I think,
which would require, and to do that in 10 days.
At the end of 10 days, it was seen that they were better in appearance and fatter than flesh than all the
fatter
youths
of flesh.
The king's food. It's crazy. Like, yeah, I was like, I thought it was a pretty funny irony for my mom, who like went on the Daniel diet to lose weight. I was like, did you read the end of that story?
Yeah,
like,
be careful.
Because
if God honors this
if God
diet,
honors this diet, you're going to gain weight after miserably eating vegetables for only 10 days long she did it for.
Yeah, and so it happens, and what God is saying there is he's proving that he is the God in control.
Right, and what's interesting is then it also makes you think that the food being offered by Nebuchadnezzar isn't just food. It's sacred.
Oh, he might be offering them sacred priestly temple food.
Or
is that what you're saying?
Yes, yeah. It could be offered in favor of his gods, or to eat his food is a symbol of bowing to him.
Totally.
Right.
I mean, it's food. It's very likely that it would be food sacrificed to idols. And the people of Babylon were bringing the animals into the king's court. They were killing it to the name of the king's god. And then the indoctrinants of whom Daniel was one were made to eat it.
Yeah.
And it was like, oh, great. In eating this food, you're accepting the reign of the king's gods. And he's like, I will not defile myself with that kind of food.
Yeah.
And God honors it.
Okay. So what's on the line in all this is who's really in charge? Is God in charge? Or is Nebuchadnezzar in charge? And is Daniel willing to trust a God who sends him into exile? Or will he trust the king who has all the trappings of the empire?
Yeah.
And Daniel chooses to trust the God who sent him into exile. This is a really significant moment, just like for believers, for Christians, for the biblical narrative. A lot of scholars also point out that Daniel is not the first person to have this narrative arc. Joseph has this same narrative arc. He, by his brothers, is thrown into a pit. He's stolen. We're told he's stolen from the land of the Hebrews, just like Daniel is stolen from the land of the Hebrews.
And we find out at the end of Genesis that it was God who did that.
That was God who did that. Yeah, the very end of Genesis interprets that as saying, what you intended for evil,
God intended for
good.
Okay.
You also have a moment where we haven't got to the interpretation of the dream yet, but he'll interpret dreams just like Daniel does. And there's also, before he ever interprets a dream, just like before Daniel ever interprets a dream, there's a test with Potiphar's wife.
Right.
He's invited to sleep with the ruler of the home, the ruler of the home's wife, and he chooses to remain faithful to God rather than avail himself of the bounty of the empire. And it's in that process he's actually goes further down into exile. So there's a risk. Like, this is if you're paying attention to the biblical story, we don't know if this test will work out in Daniel's favor.
Right.
Daniel doesn't know if this will work out in his favor. And also mirrors what happens in the fiery furnace. They say it, Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego, before they go in the fire, they say, we don't know. Like, God, we believe God will rescue us. But if he doesn't, we don't know how this story is going to end here. Right. But there's also a hope in the Joseph story that he could be raised up.
Right.
Just like, and he became the vizier of Egypt.
Yeah.
Is the same thing on the line here. And what's interesting, I think, is that that same invitation to accept the God of exile is the same invitation that Jesus offers us. He says, if you want to follow me, pick up your cross.
Right.
You must die if you want to live. When Christians don't choose God, Jesus, because he offers a better life in Babylon, they must trust the God of exile. All the information we have about God, Daniel's trust in God, is one based off of...
He sent him into exile.
Sending him into exile. There's hope that maybe in the future he could restore.
Right.
But the trust that Daniel is giving God is one like, I can trust you with death and exile and being potentially put into the pit. And I would rather do that than enjoy the food of Babylon.
That's what Jesus is calling us to, is like, it's better for you to obey me, even whenever it means eating vegetables. Because you'll have life.
Even if it means joining me in my death.
Right.
So that you might join me in my resurrection.
That's right.
Yeah.
Yeah. Because ultimately, let's just say it, like, this is a picture of Jesus. Jesus endured the ultimate test.
Like Daniel and Joseph, he was sent into exile.
That's
among
right.
the Romans.
That's right.
Yeah.
And he, in the Garden of Gethsemane, was faced with a choice.
Well, before that,
yeah.
in the wilderness.
Yes. Oh, yes. Yeah, the temptations.
Satan, the temptation offers him food.
Right.
Just like Daniel's offered food here.
Yep.
He has a choice. Do you want to rule the world with me, the king of the world? So bow.
Right.
So he's offered the same choice Daniel
has. It's better to starve in the desert and be with God than to feast at the king's table and rule the world with Satan.
Right. And then right after that story in all the gospel accounts, Jesus is lifted up. He's baptized. The clouds open up. God speaks
right
from heaven.
Right before this story. Right before the temptations.
Yes. Right. And he's ascended. He's the chosen one of God.
Uh-huh.
And so here we're wondering, like, will this result in the same thing? Daniel is going to be risen up above all the magicians here in a second, just like Jesus is risen up above all his enemies. Yeah,
that's interesting. But ultimately, though, going back to the Garden of Gethsemane too, is like,
yes, sorry.
There's that test of like, will you follow the will of God, the will of the Father, Jesus? Not my will, but your will be done. Let this cup pass moment, right?
Right.
And Jesus passes the test. He lays down his life because he trusts that death with God's plan is better than life without it. And what happens? He's raised up.
That's right.
Just like Joseph was, just like Daniel will be. And he proves whose God is really in control. The gods of this world claim that they hold all the cards, that death is in their hand, and they wield it against whomever they will. But Jesus and Daniel and Joseph again and again and again prove that true life and true ruling happens whenever we obey God's commands, despite the fact that it looks like they'll end in our death.
Man. Yes.
Ugh.
Yeah, it's almost as if like the cry of those faithful to the Lord, the cry of those faithful to Jesus always has to be, despite what it looks like, I know God is in control.
Right.
And that's what it means to have faith in Jesus. That's what it means to be saved. That's what it means to invite Jesus into your heart, is to look at the empire of the world, look at all that it offers you, know that it could kill you if you refuse, and then choose to accept the calling of the God who sends you into exile, the calling of the God who invites you to die, the calling of the God who says, you will be persecuted for my name's sake, the calling of the God who says, count the cost
right.
before you accept me. Because, right? Like,
oh man, I mean, I'm just thinking about a lot. I mean, I just want to say it again, and then I want to make another point. Because it's like, it is amazing to think about the cross as a test.
Mm-hmm.
And it's like Jesus knew that God's power was greater than the power of the grave.
Yes.
And the promise of the empires of this world. And so he laid down his life. He put it all on the line, right? He ate the broccoli and drank the water.
Yeah.
Right? And God honored him by raising him up above every name and putting him on a throne.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm just like, man, this happens all the time. Like in our lives, we're like, man, I noticed something sinful and wrong at my job. My boss or my direct report was doing something just wrong. And I know if I bring it up, I'm going to get fired. And it's like, well, I better just go ahead and eat the red meat and drink the wine and tip my hat to the king of Babylon, because I got to keep myself safe.
Right.
I have to look out for myself. And if I obey God here, I'm going to lose everything.
Yeah.
And it's like, no.
Yeah.
God, Jesus proved, Daniel proved, Joseph proved that if you obey God's commands and you eat the broccoli and drink the water, you lay down your life.
Right.
He will raise you up.
Yeah.
Despite what it looks like, he will raise you up.
Yeah.
And like, we're presented with this test all the time.
Yeah. Yeah, because the hope of resurrection isn't just an eternal hope.
No.
Which it is.
It is.
Like, why is it worth dying first? Because resurrection's on the other side.
That's right.
Obviously. But like, the book of Daniel has all these mini resurrections.
Yes.
These moments when the exiled Jew becomes, I mean, that's what, I'll go ahead and read it in a second. But like, the exiled Jew becomes the prime minister of Babylon above everybody.
Right. And whether or not it results in a physical promotion to a higher job doesn't matter. Because what matters is if you try to save your life, you're going to lose it. But if you lose your life for me, you're going to save it. It's like you are going to put a curse on yourself by letting your boss, by sweeping the thing your boss did under the rug.
Yeah.
And it's going to kill you a little bit. It's going to be death to you. You're going to lose life in that. But if you stand up for what God has for you in that moment, he's going to give you life that you didn't even know was possible because you laid down your life for him.
Yeah.
It's like our lives can be filled with constant little resurrections whenever we eat the broccoli and drink the water.
Yeah.
Yeah. That's cool. It just shows that God's just more powerful.
Right.
I just think that's the main thing to take away from this is that like God's more powerful than you think. Even whenever you're exiled, even when the temple's destroyed, even when it looks like God couldn't reach you, he's more powerful than your present circumstance.
And here's what that looked like for Daniel in Babylon. And for these four youths, God gave them, in response to their eating the broccoli, learning and skill in all literature and wisdom. So they excel at the king's indoctrination. God gives them special skill to understand Babylonian culture all the way down.
Right.
They were the best indoctrinees, not because they were indoctrinated, but because God gave them the ability to see through Babylon clearly. And then Daniel had understanding, we're told, also in visions and dreams. This sets up basically the rest of the book of Daniel. You need to know that. He has a special skill for vision and dream, like Joseph did in the Joseph narratives. And at the end of the time, end of the 3 years, when the king had commanded that they should be brought in, the king spoke with them, and he found that Daniel, Hananiah, Mishael, and Azariah, interesting that it's their Hebrew names here.
Not Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego.
Right, which is what you would expect when you're in the king's court.
Yes.
It's a proof that God is elevating them and protecting them as the people of God rather than acolytes of Babylon.
Their Jewishness is not getting crushed under the indoctrination of their Babylonian-ishness.
And in every matter of wisdom and understanding about which the king inquired of them, he found them 10 times better than all the magicians.
One day
they ate broccoli.
Oh, that's good. Yeah. That's really interesting. They graduated from Babylonian school summa cum laude.
Yeah. Than all the other magicians and enchanters in the kingdom. And Daniel was there until the first year of King Cyrus. So that kind of gives us an inclusio of how long Daniel lasts. Which, just think about this. So what is Daniel's reward for passing the test? He's given knowledge of all the literature and language of Babylon.
Right.
He's found better than all the magicians and enchanters. And he lasts through three successive empires within Babylon. Just imagine being the prime advisor to three different administrations over the course of 70 years in exile. That's unheard of.
Right.
Nobody is on Obama's cabinet, Trump's cabinet, and Biden's cabinet.
No,
like, that doesn't happen. That doesn't happen. Much less if China came in and then Russia came in.
And
like,
you're on their advisor.
You're the best advisor to Putin, Xi Jinping, and Trump. Like
that would never happen.
How does that happen? It does not happen.
You would have to be the wisest.
Daniel is given a seat next to power for his entire life. It's a mini He's ascended to a throne
because he laid his life down.
Right.
Which is why when Jesus lays his life down, he is ruler not over one kingdom, but of every kingdom. Over China, over Russia, over America, over every nation, Jesus reigns over all. Why? Because he laid his life down.
Yeah.
Yeah. For all nations.
Yeah.
That's interesting.
There's something about the humility of Daniel here that will be picked up again in chapters four and five with Nebuchadnezzar and Belshazzar. He lays his life down. He humbly submits to the will of the Lord rather than to the king of Babylon. And he's elevated to a throne like Nebuchadnezzar is, but Belshazzar isn't. You have the introduction of wisdom. Like, it's setting, there's a sense in Daniel 1, there's also like a table of contents for all the themes that are going to be set up. We're talking about exile and temple, wisdom, visions, dreams, humility, humbling.
A test that
will get picked up later. Like,
all of these things are laid out.
Yeah.
Yeah. Man, that's crazy. Oh, vegetables.
Vegetables.
Daniel 1.
Why is it good news that the call of Jesus is a call to death first? Because it could have been that Jesus said come to me that you might have life and life abundantly.
Right.
That's part of the message of good news.
Yeah, but what does coming to him look like?
Why?
It looks like death.
Why must we pass through death? Why does Israel have to pass through exile? Mm. Why must Daniel be in Babylon for God to raise him up? Why does Jesus have to die so he gets sent to the throne? Why is it good news that we start low before we go high?
I have two answers. I'm sure you have more.
I don't know if I do, but we'll see.
Here's my two answers. I'll give them short, and then we can unpack them. First, it's because we must die because of our sin. Mm-hmm. And that's why Israel's in exile. We said that at the very beginning of the episode.
That's right.
Why is Israel in exile? Because of their sin.
Mm-hmm.
So why must our path to Jesus' life start with death? Because of our sin, we must die.
Mm-hmm.
And then two, it's because we have to kill the pride out of ourselves. Like, in order for us to know that God reigns supreme, we first have to kill our own little king. Like, we all are our own little king, you know, that thinks that we're autonomous and that we could build a citadel all the way up to the sky, like the Tower of Babel. And we think we could do it. We think we could run the universe. And that little king has to die in order for the ultimate king to live in us. We have to see that king die. We have to die to that king, die to self. We have to die to our autonomy to submit to his sovereignty. So, I mean, I think those are my two gut responses to why death in order to have life.
Yeah. That's why the necessity of it.
Mm-hmm.
Like, why is that good news?
Yeah.
Why is it good news that it's in the context of death and pride and Babylon? That's when we're raised up.
Yeah.
And I think
there's good news in both of those.
Yeah.
Yeah.
On my end, I'm thinking it's good news that the narrative arc starts at the bottom, that life comes after death.
Right. The death's not the end is good news.
Right. Because it's like, well, what it proves is that God is powerful in the bottom of the barrel. The God is the God that can raise the meekest, the lowliest, the most oppressed.
Mm-hmm.
God is the God that works within the belly of the biggest and baddest empires. Why is it good news that God works from the middle of death and exile? Why is it that God uses evil to accomplish his purposes?
Mm.
Is because that proves his greatness. That proves he's able to overcome and to offer true life. If the problems were easier, the rescue wouldn't be
if
the stakes were lower, the good news wouldn't be as good.
Right.
He's upped the ante. It must happen from death so that he can actually rescue from all evil and all death and all sin. It has to be in the belly of the biggest and baddest beast.
Right.
In order for us to resurrect
fully,
finally, forever.
Right. Yeah, that's really good. I think it's also really good news in those two reasons I brought up too. Like, it's good news because we have to die anyway.
Yeah.
Right? For several reasons. One, mortally, we have to die. Death is part of life.
Yeah.
We have to die.
Our cells stop multiplying.
That's right. And that's because I think of the fall.
Yeah.
And the curse. And so, death, physical death is a result of a spiritual revolt.
Hmm.
Like, we ran from God, and so we die. We ran away from the tree of life, and so we can't live forever. So now we have to die. So it's good news that even though we have to die, we will live.
Hmm.
And that's from a physical standpoint.
One of the other authors on staff, Christine, she pointed out all this Eden imagery in the Babylon story that I was like, I don't know, but it's coming out to me finally right here.
Mm.
She says, basically, Nebuchadnezzar is setting up an anti-Eden.
Yes.
He's setting up a new version of Eden where the people must pass a test first. Just eat of this food
Oh, right.
Take of my food at the king's table, and then you will have understanding of all the language and literature of Babylon. But when he refuses to eat the food, he's given the understanding. Daniel's given understanding that does what? That gives him life in Babylon, raises him to a throne, and allows for the people of God to be at peace in exile.
Right. Yeah. And
thank
like
you,
whenever, and yeah, and whenever he refuses the food, we see the reverse of the fall.
Mm-hmm.
Because the fall came whenever Eve and Adam did eat the food offered
right.
by the king of Babylon, the serpent,
yeah.
right? It was promised that that snake's head would be crushed. Well, then what happens after Daniel refuses the food and is given all wisdom and knowledge, we then see in chapter 2 that all kingdoms of which Babylon's gold head is at the top get crushed. And so whenever you have somebody pass the test.
Yeah.
And
do you know where that, in chapter 2, the meteor, the rock,
uh-huh.
it strikes the feet. Strikes
right.
the heel.
Yeah, the heel.
The heel. It strikes the heel.
Oh, come on. Which is, if you missed that, Genesis 3:15
yeah.
talks about the snake's head getting crushed by the heel.
Yeah, and yeah. so it's interesting to think of the Garden of Gethsemane or the temptation by Satan in the wilderness as new tests
That's
for
right.
Jesus.
Absolutely.
He's a new Daniel being offered the same test.
A new Adam, a new Eve.
A new Adam, a new Eve, and he passes it, and what happens? He's ascended to a throne and makes peace for people living in exile. Still, like, I mean, the first believers were still in exile under Rome,
mm-hmm.
but Jesus was ascended to his throne, and he gave them peace
yes.
and eternal life, even in the belly of empire.
Right. So that's good news.
Great news.
I think that my second point also has good news, and it's that, and my second point was that we all have these little kings in us that want to rule, and they
yeah.
need to die first in order to know that God rules. That's really good news, because there is a huge lie in the world that it's better to be King Nebuchadnezzar than it is to be a servant in his kingdom.
Mm.
Right? Right. That, like,
yeah.
it would be better to be the king. It would be better to be in control than to let somebody else be in control. That it would be better to have all the power than to submit to power. And that's just, we all believe that is very true.
Yeah.
Autonomy is better mm-hmm. than servitude. We just,
yeah.
we. I mean, the
right.
Everybody listening is probably like, yeah, that's it. But that's
right.
not the biblical dream.
Yeah, that's what built Babel
yes.
and what God destroyed.
That's what led to the fall.
That's what led to confusion.
Yes. And it's like, we are called to be free from that lie. That first lie that the serpent told, and now that Nebuchadnezzar's touting, right? That Satan tried to tout to Jesus. It happens over and over and over again. That autonomy and self-control and self-reliance are ultimate goods.
Mm-hmm.
And the good news is that when we die to that, we actually get life. And life is submission to God.
Mm.
And like, that's
yeah.
actually life. That's actually a better way to live. And the better way to be human is to be an apprentice of Jesus, a submitter to the law of God. That's actually a better way to live.
Yeah. This is just funny. I don't think what's implied by what you're saying. All that's good news. But it's like, heavy is the head that wears the crown.
Mm-hmm.
And if you have a good king, a universal sovereign, providing resurrection life, and you have... don't have to rule that kingdom.
Yeah.
If you're the one who Ugh. Doesn't have to die for the sins of mankind,
let's
if
go.
You're the one who doesn't have to adjudicate all the complicated justice, and you could just accept the rule of a perfect sovereign, I mean, that feels like an easier yoke to live under.
Yeah.
Like, oh, great, yeah. A perfect king who does perfect justice every time
yeah.
and offers eternal life from his table, okay, I don't have to be in charge.
I'd rather be a citizen in that kingdom than run it.
Yes.
Yes.
Yes. I don't have to rule.
I don't
like, want to
be the perfect king, because I can't be. I think I can be, and I ruin everything in my life. When I'm sovereign, everything gets ruined. When God is sovereign, I can have peace in his kingdom.
Yeah.
That's good news.
That's good news.
And Daniel, the amazing thing about Daniel is able, in the belly of the beast, under not a good king, right? He's able to like build a little mini Eden.
Mm-hmm.
Right? He's able to live under the sovereign rule of the one true king in the
yeah.
midst of exile.
Yeah. yeah, and his narrative is that his little kingdom of Eden extends to all the people of God in Babylon.
It starts to grow.
It starts to grow. That's
Daniel.
Why Jeremiah and Ezekiel can prophesy about their time in Babylon with some degree of peace and hope. God's people thrive in Babylon
mm-hmm.
because Daniel built Eden inside of Babylon.
That's right. He was a blessing to Babylon and to Israel.
And to Israel.
All the nations that were ruled by Babylon were blessed because of Daniel's involvement there, because he built Eden, because he obeyed God's commands.
Yeah.
That's amazing. Yeah. So I think that's why it's good news that death comes first, that like we can put our lives on the line like Daniel did with the test. Like, why are tests good news?
Right.
It's like, because dying to self and laying down our life and submitting to the king is actually a better way to live.
Let's ask a different question. Okay. The same thing. Why is it good that a priest passes the test?
Oh, yes.
So we set up, like, what is a priest? A priest is someone who provides connection with God, and he's also ruling alongside the true king to administer the proper kingdom of justice in God's land. So the temple, like, why is it good that a priest passes the test and inaugurates a new temple? Like,
right. Well, we see kind of some of the fruit of that in this story. So Daniel's the one who initiates the test.
Mm-hmm.
And then Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego, you know, his three compatriots kind of get swept along with him. And they obey with him, but Daniel was the intermediate.
Yeah,
he's the one who went to the chief of the eunuchs and put everything on the line. And so he intermediates for his friends, and they get the blessing along with him.
Yeah.
And then he also ends up intermediating for the king himself, because now the king has advisors 10 times as wise as everyone else.
Right, the king is blessed.
The king is blessed. So Daniel's now mediating for the nations and the Jews.
Mm-hmm.
And he's the stand-in. How? By doing what priests have always done in the temple, obeying the law, keeping themselves undefiled and without blemish in the midst of their labor.
We talked about Daniel building an Eden within Babylon, but he's also building a new temple. And he's building a kingdom of God within Babylon.
Yeah.
All of the national and religious imagery that comes with temples and nations and kingdoms, there's also happening simultaneous. And we talked about how Nebuchadnezzar is offering another way to worship, another religion, the religion of self, the religion of autonomy. And even there, Daniel's offering another way to rule, and he's building a new kingdom and a new religion that brings blessing to all people. What did the rule of empire do? What did the empire of self do? It colonized.
That's right.
But the kingdom that follows God's word blesses all people.
Even those that would seek to curse them.
Yes.
Even Nebuchadnezzar, who annexed the temple, gets blessed, because that's how God's kingdom works.
Mm.
That's amazing. So how does Jesus do that? How's Jesus the priest who blesses by laying his life down? I mean, I've just said
You've
it.
Just,
but, you
I
know,
mean,
it's
yeah.
just the question. The answer
is
the question.
I mean, he had the test of the God out of the gift Gethsemane. He accepted the exile of the grave and of the cross.
Yes.
He was resurrected and inaugurates not just a new Eden for his people, but a new kingdom for his people, new citizenship for his people.
He's our intermediary, too, where it's like, we don't have to be Daniel. We get to be Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego.
Yeah.
Right. He is the one who goes up to the powers and put everything on the line and said, I'm going to eat vegetables even if it kills me.
Mm-hmm.
And it did kill him. But then we get the blessing along with him.
Yeah.
Like, he's our intermediary.
Right.
He's a better priest. He goes.
He leads. He's the king
this
new kingdom Eden thing.
Yeah. Instead of just taking the sacrifices to the altar, he is the sacrifice on the altar.
Mm-hmm.
Like, he's like, I'll lay my life down with broccoli and water if I have to, you know, and Jesus does that. And that's why he's just a better priest. That's so good.
The priest that passed the test.
The priest that passes the test. Daniel 1.
Yeah. And there's all sorts of other priests that fail to pass the test.
Yes.
We didn't mention the wine, but he refuses the king's wine.
Mm-hmm.
There's nothing wrong with wine in Hebrew culture. But do you remember Nadab and Abihu in the book of Numbers?
Yes.
They offer strange fire to the Lord right after an incident of drinking. There's a story about drinking, and then right after that, there's strange fire that's offered to the Lord. And the implication is maybe it had something to do with drinking, the reason why they were bad priests to God. They were priests that failed the test and were consumed by the fire of God instead.
Right.
So here we have another offer of implication of wine, new priests passing the test. Anyway, I'm just now spinning about how, there's always been tests that are unique for priests.
That's true. Or think about Korah's rebellion and the test that was given with all the bowls and everything Aaron.
Yeah.
And it proved who God's true priest was, or with his staff that budded in the temple and all that stuff. There's another theme that we're just noticing here, which is like there are tests for priests.
Yeah.
But they're not always passed.
They're not always passed.
Yeah. It's also another way to say if Daniel did pass this test and said, I'm going to eat vegetables and get fat, And that's going to prove that I am God's priest, just like Aaron's budding staff proved right. that he was God's priest.
Yeah, and so maybe then the implication is that because Jesus passed the test, he's qualified to build a new temple. It's not that he's qualified to build a new kingdom, although he is, mm-hmm. because he's a ruler like right. Daniel. It's not that he's qualified to build a new Eden because he's a new Adam like Daniel, even though he is. He's a qualified to build a new temple because he's passed the test of the priest.
That's right.
Aaron built the first temple with Moses, or the tabernacle with Moses, yeah. because he was qualified. He passed the test.
Right.
And he builds a new temple in himself. Jesus is the temple where we find access to God and proper aligning to his value and his culture and his literature.
Right. How did the king know that Daniel was going to be a trustworthy advisor? It's because he passed the test, right? There was a miracle that proved that something is different with Daniel. Mm-hmm. In an even much, much better way, Jesus passed the test of going to the grave. And it's proved that he is the final high priest that we need for being an intermediary because he was raised from the grave.
Yeah.
Why should we trust Jesus? Because he passed the final test. He rose from the grave.
Rose from the grave.
Yeah.
He refused the devil in the wilderness. He went through the garden and didn't do his own will. Oh, we keep talking about Babel as the empire of autonomy, the empire of self-rule, the empire of self-worship.
Not my will,
not
but yours.
Not my will, but yours. He reverses Babel. He passes the test of Babel.
That's right.
In the Garden of Gethsemane, which qualifies him to build a temple, not to his own will and self-worship, but to God, the true worship of God in himself.
Right. Which, just to say, Jesus does say that he kind of becomes the new tower or the new Jacob's ladder, this connection between God and man. In John, he says that you will see angels ascending and descending on the Son of Man.
That's right.
You know, where he's like, he is the connection between heaven and earth that Babel tried to build.
Interesting.
Anyway, just like a little sidebar. Man, Daniel 1.
Daniel 1. Okay. So if you remember from our introductory episode, there's chiasms in Daniel.
That's right.
This is the introduction of Daniel in exile. Mm-hmm. And we've just said, like, when the people of God are in exile, what's the line? Exile, temple, visions, wisdom.
The priesthood.
The priesthood.
Yeah.
Universal sovereignty.
lots on the line.
There's lots on the line, and it's all introduced in the first chapter.
Yeah.
And all those things are going to get picked up again in the final chapters in 8 through 12.
That's right.
We'll get there in a few weeks, but next week we'll be in Daniel chapter 2, where we talk about a vision of a giant statue being smashed by a meteor.
Right. And it represents four kingdoms. It has its mirror in Daniel 7 in the vision of the four beasts.
That's right. So we'll talk about that next week.
Yeah.
And how Daniel gets promoted to the minister of magic. The position of the minister of magic within Babylon.
That's awesome. Well, yeah. Thank you guys so much for being with us here in Daniel chapter 1. We'll see you next week in Daniel chapter 2.
Thank you for listening to the Spoken Gospel Podcast. Spoken Gospel creates short films, devotionals, and podcasts like this one. Everything we make is free because of generous supporters like you. To see our resources, visit SpokenGospel.com or subscribe to our YouTube channel. Thanks for listening. See you next week.